Chapter 60. Baby Charles became King Charles I, in the 25th year of his age. Unlike his father, he was usually amiable in his private character, and grave and dignified in his bearing. But, like his father, he had monstrously exaggerated notions of the rights of a king, and was evasive, and not to be trusted. If his word could have been relied upon, his history might have had a different end. His first care was to send over that insolent upstart, Buckingham, to bring Henrietta Maria from Paris to be his queen, upon which occasion Buckingham with his usual audacity made love to the young Queen of Austria, and was very indignant indeed with Cardinal Richelieu, the French minister, for thwarting his intentions. The English people were very well disposed to like their new queen, and to receive her with great favor, when she came among them as a stranger. But, she held the Protestant religion in great dislike, and brought over a crowd of unpleasant priests, who made her do some very ridiculous things, and forced themselves upon the public notice in many disagreeable ways. Hence, the people soon came to dislike her, and she soon came to dislike them, and she did, so much all through this reign in setting the king who was dotingly fond of her, against his subjects, that it would have been better for him, if she had never been born. Now, you are to understand that King Charles I of his own determination, to be a high and mighty king, not to be called to account by anybody, and urged on by his queen besides deliberately set himself to put his parliament down and to put himself up. You are also to understand, that even in pursuit of this wrong idea enough in itself to have ruined any king, he never took a straight course, but always took a crooked one. He was bent upon war with Spain, though neither the House of Commons, nor the people were quite clear, as to the justice of that war, now that they began to think a little more about the story of the Spanish match. But the king rushed into it hotly, raised money by illegal means to meet its expenses, and encountered a miserable failure at Cadiz, in the very first year of his reign. An expedition to Cadiz had been made in the hope of plunder, but as it was not successful, it was necessary to get a grant of money from the Parliament. And when they met, in no very complying humor, the king told them to make haste to let him have it, or it would be the worse for themselves. Apostrophe not put in a more complying humor by this, they impeached the king's favorite, the Duke of Buckingham, as the cause, which he undoubtedly was, of many great public grievances and wrongs. The king, to save him, dissolved the parliament without getting the money he wanted, and when the lords implored him to consider, and grant a little delay, he replied, "No, not 1 minute." Apostrophe he then began to raise money for himself by the following means among others. He levied certain duties called tonnage and poundage which had not been granted by the Parliament, and could lawfully be levied by no other power. He called upon the seaport towns to furnish, and to pay all the cost for 3 months of, a fleet of armed ships, and he required the people to unite in lending him large sums of money, the repayment of which was very doubtful. If the poor people refused, they were pressed as soldiers or sailors. If the gentry refused, they were sent to prison. 5 gentlemen, named Sir Thomas Darnall, John Corbett, Walter Earle, John Evenningham, and Everard Hampden, for refusing were taken up by a warrant of the King's Privy Council, and were sent to prison without any cause, but the King's pleasure being stated for their imprisonment. Then the question came to be solemnly tried, whether this was not a violation of Magna Charta, and an encroachment by the King on the highest rights of the English people. His lawyers contended no, because to encroach upon the rights of the English people would be to do wrong, and the king could do no wrong. The accommodating judges decided in favor of this wicked nonsense, and here was a fatal division between the king and the people. For all this, it became necessary to call another parliament. The people, sensible of the danger in which their liberties were, chose for it those who were best known for their determined opposition to the king. But still the king, quite blinded by his determination to carry everything before him, addressed them when they met, in a contemptuous manner, and just told them in so many words, that he had only called them together because he wanted money. The parliament, strong enough and resolute enough to know that they would lower his tone, cared little for what he said, and laid before him one of the great documents of history, which is called the Petition of Right, requiring that the free men of England should no longer be called upon to lend the king money, and should no longer be pressed or imprisoned for refusing to do so. Further, that the free men of England should no longer be seized by the king's special mandate or warrant, it being contrary to their rights and liberties and the laws of their country. At first the king returned an answer to this petition, in which he tried to shirk it altogether. But, the House of Commons then showing their determination to go on with the impeachment of Buckingham, the king in alarm returned an answer, giving his consent to all that was required of him. He not only afterwards departed from his word and honor on these points, over and over again, but, at this very time, he did the mean and dissembling act of publishing his first answer, and not his second, merely that the people might suppose that the parliament had not got the better of him. That pestilent Buckingham, to gratify his own wounded vanity, had by this time involved the country in war with France, as well as with Spain. For such miserable causes and such miserable creatures are wars sometimes made. But he was destined to do little more mischief in this world. One morning, as he was going out of his house to his carriage, he turned to speak to a certain Colonel Fryer who was with him, and he was violently stabbed with a knife, which the murderer left sticking in his heart. This happened in his hall. He had had angry words upstairs, just before, with some French gentlemen, who were immediately suspected by his servants, and had a close escape from being set upon and killed. In the midst of the noise, the real murderer, who had gone to the kitchen, and might easily have got away, drew his sword and cried out, "I am the man." His name was John Felton, a Protestant and a retired officer in the army. He said he had had no personal ill will to the Duke, but had killed him as a curse to the country. He had aimed his blow well, for Buckingham had only had time to cry out, "Villain!" And then he drew out the knife, fell against a table, and died. The council made a mighty business of examining John Felton about this murder, though it was a plain case enough, one would think. He had come 70 miles to do it, he told them, and he did it for the reason he had declared. If they put him upon the rack, as that noble Marquis of Dorset whom he saw before him had the goodness to threaten, he gave that Marquis warning that he would accuse him as his accomplice. The king was unpleasantly anxious to have him racked, nevertheless. But as the judges now found out that torture was contrary to the law of England, it is a pity they did not make the discovery a little sooner. John Felton was simply executed for the murder he had done. A murder it undoubtedly was, and not in the least to be defended. Though he had freed England from one of the most profligate, contemptible, and base court favorites to whom it has ever yielded. A very different man now arose. This was Sir Thomas Wentworth, a Yorkshire gentleman, who had sat in Parliament for a long time, and who had favored arbitrary and haughty principles, but who had gone over to the people's side on receiving offense from Buckingham. The king, much wanting such a man for, besides being naturally favorable to the king's cause, he had great abilities, made him first a baron, and then a viscount, and gave him high employment, and won him most completely. A parliament, however, was still in existence, and was not to be won. On the 20th of January, 1629, Sir John Eliot, a great man who had been active in the Petition of Right, brought forward other strong resolutions against the king's chief instruments, and called upon the Speaker to put them to the vote. To this the Speaker answered, he was commanded otherwise by the king, and got up to leave the chair, which, according to the rules of the House of Commons, would have obliged it to adjourn without doing anything more, when two members, named Mr. Hollis and Mr. Valentine, held him down. A scene of great confusion arose among the members, and while many swords were drawn and flashing about, the king, who was kept informed of all that was going on, told the captain of his guard to go down to the house and force the doors. The resolutions were by that time, however, voted, and the house adjourned. Sir John Eliot and those two members who had held the speaker down were quickly summoned before the council. As they claimed it to be their privilege not to answer out of Parliament for anything they had said in it, they were committed to the Tower. The king then went down and dissolved the Parliament in a speech wherein he made mention of these gentlemen as vipers which did not do him much good that ever I have heard of. As they refused to gain their liberty by saying they were sorry for what they had done, the king, always remarkably unforgiving, never overlooked their offense. When they demanded to be brought up before the Court of King's Bench, he even resorted to the meanness of having them moved about from prison to prison, so that the writs issued for that purpose should not legally find them. At last they came before the court, and were sentenced to heavy fines, and to be imprisoned during the king's pleasure. When Sir John Eliot's health had quite given way, and he so longed for change of air and scene, as to petition for his release, the king sent back the answer worthy of his soship himself, that the petition was not humble enough. When he sent another petition by his young son, in which he pathetically offered to go back to prison, when his health was restored, if he might be released for its recovery, the king still disregarded it. When he died in the Tower, and his children petitioned to be allowed to take his body down to Cornwall, there to lay it among the ashes of his forefathers, the king returned for answer, let Sir John Eliot's body be buried in the church of that parish where he died. All this was like a very little king indeed, I think. And now, for 12 long years, steadily pursuing his design of setting himself up and putting the people down, the king called no parliament, but ruled without one. If 12,000 volumes were written in his praise, as a good many have been, it would still remain a fact, impossible to be denied, that for 12 years King Charles I reigned in England unlawfully and despotically, seized upon his subjects' goods and money at his pleasure, and punished according to his unbridled will all who ventured to oppose him. It is a fashion with some people to think that this king's career was cut short. But I must say myself, that I think he ran a pretty long one. William Laud, Archbishop of Canterbury, was the king's right-hand man in the religious part of the putting down of the people's liberties. Laud, who was a sincere man, of large learning, but small sense, for the two things sometimes go together in very different quantities, though a Protestant, held opinions so near those of the Catholics, that the Pope wanted to make a cardinal of him, if he would have accepted that favor. He looked upon vows, robes, lighted candles, images, and so forth, as amazingly important in religious ceremonies, and he brought in an immensity of bowing and candle snuffing. He also regarded archbishops and bishops as a sort of miraculous persons, and was inveterate in the last degree against any who thought otherwise. Accordingly, he offered up thanks to heaven, and was in a state of much pious pleasure, when a Scotch clergyman, named Leighton, was pilloried, whipped, branded in the cheek, and had one of his ears cut off, and one of his nostrils slit, for calling bishops trumpery and the inventions of men. He originated on a Sunday morning the prosecution of William Prynne, a barrister who was of similar opinions, and who was fined £1,000, who was pilloried. who had his ears cut off on two occasions, 1 year at a time, and who was imprisoned for life. He highly approved of the punishment of Dr. Bastwick, a physician, who was also fined £1,000, and who afterwards had his ears cut off, and was imprisoned for life. These were gentle methods of persuasion, some will tell you. I think they were rather calculated to be alarming to the people. In the money part of the putting down of the people's liberties, the king was equally gentle, as some will tell you. As I think, equally alarming. He levied those duties of tonnage and poundage, and increased them as he thought fit. He granted monopolies to companies of merchants on their paying him for them, notwithstanding the great complaints that had, for years and years, been made on the subject of monopolies. He fined the people for disobeying proclamations issued by his soship in direct violation of law. He revived the detested forest laws, and took private property to himself as his forest right. Above all, he determined to have what was called ship money, that is to say, money for the support of the fleet, not only from the seaports, but from all the counties of England. Having found out that, in some ancient time or other, all the counties paid it, the grievance of this ship money being somewhat too strong, John Chambers, a citizen of London, refused to pay his part of it. For this the Lord Mayor ordered John Chambers to prison, and for that John Chambers brought a suit against the Lord Mayor. Lord Say, also, behaved like a real nobleman, and declared he would not pay. But, the sturdiest and best opponent of the ship money was John Hampden, a gentleman of Buckinghamshire, who had sat among the vipers in the House of Commons, when there was such a thing, and who had been the bosom friend of Sir John Eliot. This case was tried before the 12 judges in the Court of Exchequer, and again the king's lawyer said it was impossible that ship money could be wrong, because the king could do no wrong, however hard he tried, and he really did try very hard during these 12 years. 7 of the judges said that was quite true, and Mr. Hampden was bound to pay. 5 of the judges said that was quite false, and Mr. Hampden was not bound to pay. So, the king triumphed, as he thought, by making Hampden the most popular man in England, where matters were getting to that height now, that many honest Englishmen could not endure their country, and sailed away across the seas to found a colony in Massachusetts Bay in America. It is said that Hampden himself and his relation Oliver Cromwell were going with a company of such voyagers, and were actually on board ship, when they were stopped by a proclamation, prohibiting sea captains to carry out such passengers without the royal license. But oh! It would have been well for the king, if he had let them go. This was the state of England. If Laud had been a madman just broke loose, he could not have done more mischief than he did in Scotland. In his endeavors, in which he was seconded by the king, then in person in that part of his dominions, to force his own ideas of bishops, and his own religious forms and ceremonies upon the Scotch, he roused that nation to a perfect frenzy. They formed a solemn league, which they called the Covenant, for the preservation of their own religious forms. They rose in arms throughout the whole country. They summoned all their men to prayers and sermons twice a day by beat of drum. They sang psalms, in which they compared their enemies to all the evil spirits that ever were heard of, and they solemnly vowed to smite them with the sword. At first the king tried force, then treaty, then a Scottish parliament which did not answer at all. Then he tried the Earl of Strafford, formerly Sir Thomas Wentworth, who, as Lord Wentworth, had been governing Ireland. He too, had carried it with a very high hand there, though to the benefit and prosperity of that country. Strafford and Laud were for conquering the Scottish people by force of arms. Other lords who were taken into council, recommended that a parliament should at last be called, to which the king unwillingly consented. So, on the 13th of April, 1640, the then strange sight, a parliament, was seen at Westminster. It is called the Short Parliament, for it lasted a very little while. While the members were all looking at one another, doubtful who would dare to speak, Mr. Pym arose, and set forth all that the king had done unlawfully during the past 12 years, and what was the position to which England was reduced. This great example set, other members took courage, and spoke the truth freely, though with great patience and moderation. The king, a little frightened, sent to say that, if they would grant him a certain sum on certain terms, no more ship money should be raised. They debated the matter for 2 days, and then, as they would not give him all he asked without promise or inquiry, he dissolved them. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.